Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast diving deep into nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs. In this episode, we'll discuss the 19th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 27 or Proper 22, which falls on October 8th this year. We have one content notification for this episode. We talk about diet culture a little bit when discussing the second reading.
Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
For our deep dive this week, we decided to join Isaiah and Matthew and dive into vineyards, because they're all about vineyards. So we're going to start and just give you a brief overview of the winemaking process, because that kind of sets up why we have vineyards in the first place. So in the process for making wine, you have to collect your materials and supplies, obviously. And if you're in a group, that means different supplies for bigger amounts, but also somebody else might have them. And then you pick out whatever fruit you want. We're talking about vineyards, and so we're going to probably do grapes, right? But you can make wine out of basically any fruit. And then you clean and crush the fruit, including killing any unwanted bacteria or wild yeast, unless you want to make wild yeast wine, which is a different thing. And at this part of the process, you would also strain out the skin if you are using white grapes to make white wine. Otherwise, if you're using red grapes to make red wine, keep the skin in. And then you add sweetness. So you could do honey or sugar for the yeast to be able to eat and ferment stuff. But also you can, it also will impact the taste, but you can also add more later if it's not tasty enough for you. And then you add the yeast and let it ferment, and you stir a bunch of times to make sure it's staying incorporated and all of that stuff. And then you strain it and you siphon off the stuff that needs siphoning off, which is when you'll remove the skins from the red grapes and the red wine, if you're making red wine. And then you age it and you ferment it some more for at least a month. The longer the process, the more the subtle flavors can kind of develop and be retained, especially for cooler stuff. And then you bottle the wine. It is, a simple-ish process. The enaction of it is a lot more complicated, but
the devil's in the details, you might say.
Yes, that's exactly it, Kay. And grapevines can grow in a lot of unexpected places. They tend to thrive best in climates with long, warm summers and rainy winters, where there's warm weather during the growing period that can help the grapevine to flower and the fruit to set and ripen. So that's why you get a lot of wine from California. There's also a lot of wineries in the elevated places in Chile and Argentina. It tends to be drier in those places too, and so there's a lot more use of water to make sure that the grapevines are properly watered and irrigation and stuff, which is part of the difficulties that are in California from the wildfires and from how water is diverted and used and all of that stuff. I will say that Argentina makes the best wine ever. I spent a semester in Argentina when I was in college, and it was when I turned 21, so that is where I learned not just to drink wine or red wine, but Malbec in particular. And there are a lot of places that do a lot of different ways of getting to know stuff, but my dad came to visit and we went on a trip, and so we actually stayed at a vineyard in Mendoza, Argentina, and then did a biking wine tour. It was fantastic and delightful, because you go to one vineyard, bike to the next, check it out, bike to the next, bike to the next, bike to the next. So you're not getting drunk anywhere, because you're just doing tastings and stuff. And sure. Then you're
on a bicycle and in it. The mountains. So yeah. Probably both of those things would mix very badly with
being drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they both help you not be drunk, because you're using energy to do the things.
Sure.
You have time between vineyards. It was really fun to do with my dad, honestly.
Cool.
So, yeah, but there's lots of vineyards all over the world. Obviously, France is well known for its own vineyards. But yeah, it's a very quick rundown of the basics.
Yeah, and speaking of the basics, so what about actually running a vineyard? Well, if you're ever interested in growing grapes for yourself, it's very possible to grow grapes if you're in the right kind of climate in your own backyard. And lots of people do grow very small crops, even like a half acre or less, just for their own family and interest. So grapes are generally planted after the last frost and harvested in early to mid-fall. So there are several months worth of managing and monitoring the crop as you go. Early on, you want to keep in mind what they call canopy management for vineyards, which would include the thinning of the shoots and also leaf removal. Grapes are one of those crops that you plant more plants than you actually expect to grow, and then you thin some of them out as they start coming up.
Is that like as opposed to those that, like with basil, you plant about how many you want, knowing that some are going to die, but and then as they grow, you thin them instead of actually thinning the plants themselves?
Right. So like I'm used to living among the cornfields. And so when they plant corn, they plant as many plants of corn as they expect to grow. Like they might lose a handful here and there, but the hope is that all of them grow. Okay. But when you plant grapes, you plant kind of a ton of them. And then depending on where all the different shoots for the vines come up, you thin those out so that they're spaced correctly, a few inches apart. And that allows you to have the right number of plants and also allows each plant to get the nutrients that it needs from the soil.
Nice.
So thinning out the shoots, you're thinning out the beginning growth of the vines themselves when they're still quite small and young. I've seen a couple of different estimates of exactly how long you want the shoots to be when you start thinning them out, but generally people were saying between 4 to 7 inches long. And then once the vine actually starts getting ready to make actual grapes, like it's grown to be probably several feet long and you've got it all set to make the grapes, then you start thinning out the leaf buds. This happens right after the flowers bloom. And this is how you make sure that you're going to get loose bunches of big grapes instead of over full bunches of grapes that are pushing so hard on each other that they're bruising each other. By thinning out the buds, you're making sure that not quite as many grapes will grow, and that allows the grapes that you get to be looser and not pushing on each other, and also bigger and better quality.
All right.
And there are various nutrients that you're going to add to your field in order to make sure that your crop is growing correctly, and that depends on your soil conditions, but it might include adding nitrogen, zinc, boron, potassium, or magnesium to your soil. Also, vineyards will use dormant fungicides applied to the vines themselves, and that will keep various blights and pests away. There were lists, but I figured our listeners might be listening to us while they're eating, and I figured, you know, maybe not, right? So I decided, because some of those names are very evocative, let's put it that way.
Of the blights or the fungicide?
The blights and the pests. Some of those names are, they just spark your imagination for what they might look like, let's put it that way.
In less than helpful ways if you're eating.
Yeah, especially if you're eating. And of course, most vineyards will be using multiple herbicides to keep weeds from taking over the land. So there will be a handful of those going.
I'm actually curious, while you were looking it up, I just thought of this, but do you know if there are vineyards that do organic pest and blight control, like what that would look like?
Oh, I'm sure that there are organic vineyards. I cannot imagine the amount of extra work that would involve. I did not have a chance to look up organic vineyards because you didn't warn me to in advance. But also, I did not have a chance to look that up because we were looking up all sorts of stuff for this episode. But I do know a handful of community-supported agriculture projects nearby, and one or two of those have tried for various types of organic certifications, and the way that the amount of constant hard work that that adds to your life in terms of pest and blight management, it's just astonishing. So for vineyards, I imagine that it must be just as hard for grapes as it would be for, you know, kohlrabi or cabbages or any number of other types of crops that aren't, you know, one of the big three crops like corn, soybeans, and wheat that are so well known and well understood by this point because they've been studied half to death.
Yeah. And none of those are like really mass produced. Anything that's mass produced, I think it's like more complicated to do.
Yeah,
often. Organic.
And if you've ever been to a vineyard, even a small vineyard, you will see that the vines are usually raised up 4 to 6 feet, which makes checking the vines for pests and blights much easier. And also, of course, the harvest is much easier. If you've ever seen those YouTube videos of farm workers harvesting, you know, radishes or strawberries or plants that are generally grown close to the ground, the harvesting of grapes and checking the plants throughout their growth cycle is much easier because the people doing that can, you know, stand up while they do it. And this is possible because grapes are a relatively lightweight crop.
Yeah. And I've seen like places that are not, you know, big vineyards, but have like grapes in archways and stuff.
Sure.
Because they're vines, so they can.
Yeah, often a decent number of people will grow grapes less for making wine and more for either decorative purposes or just because they like the fruit. Like that is also an option.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. And I think usually it's different grapes for fruit to eat than for wine. Like, there are particular types of grapes that are used for winemaking and aren't necessarily going to be as good for just eating raw, unfermented. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then it comes to, like, what does harvest actually look like? Because particularly in our gospel reading, right, Jesus is telling this parable about a vineyard owner and tenants who are working the land and doing the work to actually harvest. And so the process for harvesting is, again, pretty simple. The devil's in the details. It's in the actual doing of the thing. But in order to figure out which grapes to harvest when, vineyards will take samples and take Brix measurements, which measures the sugar content of the grapes. And that sugar content correlates to the alcohol content that will be in the wine. So every 2 degrees of Brix is 1 degree of alcohol content. And once they figure out if a particular area is ready for harvest, then hand picking is generally the most common way of harvesting. Certainly it is the traditional way. And people will do that in the early morning or kind of later in the evening, but less at the heat of the day. And in part, like, that's kind of just good labor, right? Like, you're not making people work under the sun in the heat of the day. But also, there is a need for speed. So the faster you can get the grapes from harvested to processing, the better it retains the flavor and the less likely it is that like bacteria and stuff are going to grow. So if you can get the grapes quickly from harvest to processing, and some vineyards will use like a cold soak or dry ice that really quickly cools the grapes, keeps them cold, that helps them retain their fruity flavors, and it, like I said, prevents or delays bacteria and stuff. But sure, because the way vineyards function and stuff, there's different time periods where more workers are needed, right? Harvest is a big time because it needs to be really fast to get stuff harvested and transported and into processing as fast as possible. And like other parts of the process can be slower or have less urgency, so don't necessarily need as many people, that sort of thing. So when we think about who is working the land and how the land is getting worked, a lot of places will hire migrant farm workers for the harvest. And that happens with a lot of different crops, not just in vineyards, but sure, in vineyards in particular. I know growing up, I think my parents did a thing for a few years where there was a vineyard near us, and at harvest time, I think like they would just invite people to come and help harvest the grapes and process them. And then like a month later, they would then give everybody like a bottle of wine or a couple bottles of wine or something. And I'm not sure if it was like a co-op that my parents bought into, so they got the shares of the work, or if they just like sure came and helped a friend who owned a vineyard. I don't know. But I do remember like fancy glass jars with basically it looks like I Dream of Jeannie's lamp full of wine, and it's decidedly not a wine bottle. But sure, I remember like occasionally having those around the house growing up. And yeah, so there are different ways to go about harvesting, but it does need to be like a quicker process. There's more demand on that stuff. So
yeah, I'm trying to remember what they're called, but there is a whole subculture of farms and vineyards and things like that that will hire middle class and upper class young kids to come and work on them as life experience and work experience for a few weeks here and there, and basically give them free room and board in exchange for working a couple of weeks. And it's especially popular in Australia and Hawaii and a handful of places in California, that it's sort of work to travel, a tourism sort of thing. So you go there, you work for a couple of weeks, and then on the weekends you have some time to go around and see the sights, which is sort of what your story reminds me of. But
yeah, but more local. That seems, you know, kind of like the intern programs at a bunch of businesses that are just basically getting free labor.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, okay. Just making sure I'm like on track with that. I was like, that sounds like labor exploitation.
Yeah, pretty much. But also a way of avoiding, you know, the intentional exploitation of migrant laborers, which happens at a lot of other farms and places growing crops like that. So if you want to learn more about vineyards in particular, as I was doing research for this episode, I came across two sources that might be helpful for you. There is a magazine called Practical Winery and Vineyard, and we can link to their website. And then there is also a book that is apparently like the great textbook of grapevines in particular, called The Science of Grapevines by Marcus Culler, which is now on its third edition.
Okay.
And also, if you're less interested in the science of grapevines and you just sort of want to know what they look like at different stages of their growing season, we also found a website that shows you pictures of what the grapevines look like at different stages. And we can link to that as well.
Nice. And it wouldn't be Nerds at Church if we didn't talk about pop culture and where vineyards and such take place or show up. And of course, I think the most iconic vineyard thing in pop culture is, of course, the I Love Lucy episode where she helps at a vineyard and she's like stomping around in the grapes. And that's part of the, like, my understanding is they do it differently nowadays. Less stomping, more machine done and more sanitized.
Yeah.
But back in the day, right, it was stomping in the wine vat things. Like both of our readings from Isaiah and from Matthew, the like very first verse that they have is that the vineyard is like dug and cleared and then there's a wine vat. And that's where the wine goes. That's where the, like, stomping and all of that stuff is.
Sure. So if you are wanting to make wine not in real life but in a video game, I know of two different options available to you now. One, of course, is Stardew Valley, where you can make wine out of any type of fruit as you move along in the game and become more advanced in the different stuff you can do with your crops. And so it's not just grape wine, but also starfruit wine and ancient fruit wine, and you make a lot of money by not only making the wine initially, but then also aging it in your basement. But there is no stomping the wine in this game.
Well, that's just disappointing.
But if you do want to stomp to make the wine, if you play The Sims 4 with the new Horse Ranch expansion pack, you can make nectar, which is because, of course, alcohol does not exist in The Sims world. But the nectar that you make does involve stomping in a vat. And you can also make nectar out of a few different crops available in The Sims, but grapes are one of them.
Nice.
And if you're looking to just watch people talk about wine and making wine in a pretty environment, the movie that immediately came to mind for me is French Kiss, which is a 1995 movie with Meg Ryan and Kevin Kline. It is a very sweet romance and decently feminist for its time. Like, it's very big into Meg Ryan turning into who she wants to be kind of thing.
Nice.
But also, Kevin Kline's attempt at a French accent is hilariously and famously terrible. It is, like, one of the legendary terrible accents of American film, and you really just have to see it to believe it. But he is clearly having a fabulous time, so good for him.
There you go.
And then also, many folks will know that Jean-Luc Picard of Star Trek Next Generation was apparently raised in a vineyard, and actual whole articles have been written about the lack of realism of the depiction of that vineyard. which I won't necessarily get into because I don't need to have an argument with Trekkies today. But I will also mention that Star Trek Lower Decks, the much more recent cartoon series, which is very fun, we find out that one of the main characters, Boimler, grew up on a vineyard in Modesto, California, which is seen in season 3, episode 1, called Strange Energies. And that is portrayed as sort of a fun contrast to Jean-Luc Picard's very serious, very French vineyard. And that was a good time.
Nice. I feel like that would be a good counterpoint kind of thing for our gospel parable, too, of your perspective shifts dramatically if your family owns the vineyard in France or you grew up working a vineyard, that sort of a thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, both of them own the vineyard. In Jean-Luc's case, it seems like only the family works the vineyard because I suppose technology is the answer to that somehow. And in Boimler's case, they are depicted to have several employees who seem to be well-treated and most of whom seem to be white, but they are all apparently also attractive young girls who are following him around and attempting and failing miserably to flirt with him because he doesn't realize that that's what's going on. So
that, wow, so both of those feel like a bit skewed depictions.
And, you know, not terribly realistic, but also it's Star Trek, so realism might not really be what they were going for.
I mean, I guess. Are you curious about how the Twilight Saga is influenced by Mormon theology?
Or why so many vampires are queer-coded?
Have you sat up at night pondering if the documentary Jesus Camp counts as a horror film?
Or have you ever wondered which slasher icon is which member of the Trinity?
Do you ever get into debates about whether the movies Casper, Ghost, and Candyman can be part of the Ghostbusters expanded universe?
Have you watched most of the Nightmare on Elm Street series before the age of 10?
What? Who does that?
Okay, maybe that one's just me. But if you answered yes to any of the other questions, then we've got the podcast for you.
And if you answered yes to Pace's question.
That too. I'm Pace, and I am the super nerdy horror person who's been a horror fan since well before the age when it was appropriate to watch these movies.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the inevitable queer coding somewhere in every horror movie. And we are the hosts of Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast hosted by two non-binary trans nerds.
Each season, we follow a horror franchise and a host of other horror and horror-adjacent movies to talk about how they connect to queerness, religion, and theology.
We feature bona fide scary movies like Halloween, The Witch, Candyman, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria.
We also have non-scary movies or low-stake horror movies like Ghostbusters, The Addams Family, Doctor Strange, and Hocus Pocus.
Our upcoming season, we are covering a galaxy far, far away by looking at the Star Wars and Alien franchises from queer, religious, and horror points of view.
So whether you're a lifelong horror master like me,
or a horror Padawan like me,
we have a place for you at Horror Nerds at Church.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you catch your podcasts.
Our first reading for this episode is from Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. The prophet tells a parable about Israel as an overgrown vineyard.
So one of the themes of this passage is just like missed, not great, just missed expectations, where the vineyard owner, presumably in this case God, just has like the wrong expectations for the vineyard, or the vineyard just like does not fit those expectations. And it reminded me of in Buffy the Vampire Slayer when there's this like conflict with the council who has like all the knowledge and sends people to like help and support and educate the slayer and train the slayer and stuff. And they have these like particular expectations of what it means to be the slayer, especially for Buffy. And those don't take into account who Buffy actually is. So Buffy's totally misses their expectations, does not follow through on their expectations, which they didn't exactly tell her in the first place. But she's like, no, I'm going to do this my way. And she does. And she does it with community and with a group. And yeah.
Sure. And as we jump into the verses, we read in verse 1, "Let me sing a song for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill." Okay, so I suppose this might be like translation or just it's been 2,000 years and cultural issues, but this seems like a weird choice for a love song. I'm just saying.
I mean, the very fertile hill part I get.
Yeah, like that seems like a, you're not really talking about a hill, but you know, if this is actually about a vineyard, either you're writing a song to the vineyard on your loved one's behalf, which seems like a weird life choice and feels like a weird gift to give someone. But also, the other option is that you're proclaiming how much you love that person because of their vineyard, which has some other somewhat troubling implications. And very much reminds me of a line in Pride and Prejudice, where Elizabeth Bennet says that her feelings about Fitzwilliam Darcy changed when she first saw his house. Now, when you actually read the book, you realize that she is making the joke that she was impressed by his wealth because his house is really spectacular. But also, when you're reading the book, you realize that that is when she suddenly met a bunch of people with very good opinions and stories about him, unlike the people who she knew before who all couldn't stand him. And also, there's this whole interesting thing in that time and place, the early 1800s in England, about how your aesthetic tastes said something about your personality, and his tastes would show him to be a reasonable and even-keeled and thoughtful kind of person. So,
if only you could determine your personality that easily.
Yeah, that would be nice, but no.
Yeah. I was looking at verse 2, and in verse 2, the vineyard owner dug the vineyard and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines and built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and they expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And this one, it was like the work in Westworld, the TV show. There's all this work that humans put into developing AI and training it and making it into this like world so that humans can come with the expectation that the AI will both interact with them like humans and never hurt them. Never put them in any actual danger. And then the AI, like, learn things and actually develop intelligence and rebel. And that is not... They get a little wild, shall we say, in sometimes deadly ways.
Yeah, I could see that being awkward.
Yeah.
And then in verse 6 we read, "I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and it shall be overgrown with briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it." Well, a lot of this, like the first three quarters of it, sounds like the native plant yard movement. The idea of getting away from mowing decorative grass and replacing it with native plants that shelter wildlife and the native insects species. Although I don't know that telling God to not let it rain will actually work, because the farmers in my neighborhood have been trying the opposite for months now with very little luck. So see how that works out for you, I guess.
I thought it was God commanding the clouds not to rain.
Well, I guess God would have that kind of power, sure.
Yeah,
I suppose it, again, it's all about whose vineyard is this actually, and are you writing a love poem to the vineyard or what?
Right. But, it's true. Yeah. It's true. So many interpretations. Indeed. And I was looking at verse 7, where it says, "For the vineyard of the everlasting of hosts is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are their pleasant planting. They expected justice, but saw bloodshed, righteousness, but heard a cry." And the, like, framing of this is a little bit weird for both this and the gospel, where it's like, these are the expectations of good, and instead you get evil. And a lot of times, that's like, you put in good, and you expect good, and then you get evil, right? But I like dystopias too much, apparently, because I was like thinking about it in terms of the Hunger Games, and like the Capitol's view of District 12 is an expectation that they won't do anything, that they will be docile, that they won't rebel, that they're just like not even worth it, right? And because they treat them that way, then District 12 is in fact the spark for the rebellion that has been building throughout the district. So it's like that, but kind of the opposite, but kind of not. But yeah, the expectation is of ongoing injustice and like oppression. And then District 12 is like, oh no. And it does result in bloodshed and cries out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole it's a dystopia might be a hint.
You know, just a little. I like dystopias. Have I mentioned that before? Hmm. And our second reading for this episode is Philippians chapter 3, verses 4b through 14. And one of the themes in this passage is the idea of comparative value. So Paul's like listing all these things. And it really just to me reads as like a MasterCard ad. I think it was MasterCard, but like back in the day where it's like circumcised on the eighth day, pain. A member of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew born of Hebrews, covenant and accountability. As to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness under the law, blameless, self-righteousness and energy. Knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, priceless. I couldn't come up with dollar amounts, so I just came up with other costs.
Yeah.
In case that was.
Also, isn't the whole, like, first line of the book of Job and the part where he's called upright and blameless the hint that it's actually a fictional account because no actual blameless person could exist?
Mm.
So, yeah, so Paul, I think you might be exaggerating just here. A tad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little full of himself.
And speaking of, as we jump into the verses, in verse 4b, we read, "If anyone else has reason to be confident in the flesh, I have more." And I realize that he immediately makes clear that this is not what he's doing, but I have to say, anyway, Paul sounds so much like the ultimate gym bro here. Buddy, there is more to life than how much you can bench press, okay? And this made me think of a joke reel that Adam Driver had filmed, I imagine with some cooperation from the Star Wars franchise, where there is a scene of him playing Kylo Ren, except that Kylo has dyed his hair blonde, and he's sitting at a cafeteria table with a handful of low-ranking Empire employees, basically, and so the phrase ran through my head from that sketch translated to Paul as, "My friend saw Paul with his shirt off and said that he has an 8-pack, that Paul is shredded," and it's not something I ever really needed in my life, but it's in my head now. So now I have shared it with you all. You're welcome.
I appreciate you. I can't say I love it, but also I do. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in verse 6, we read, "As to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness under the law, blameless." And I was thinking about this, and this is like one of those queer-coded villain rewrites. So there's like a whole history of queer coding the villains in different movies and stories, especially in Disney stuff. But then like there's been some rewrites. So I think about like Wicked as a rewrite of the Wizard of Oz series, but also the like Ursula and the fandom and like the fan theories that have developed around sure. Ursula, who was modeled after Divine, a drag queen, and the ways that like, so Paul's like, this is my villain story, but really, look, I'm good, or whatever. And like, Paul could be queer, so you know, it fits.
Yeah. If anyone needs to expand their Ursula fandom into a new series of books, the Shonen Maguire series about the character October Day includes a character called the Lushak, the Sea Witch, who is sort of the original Queen of the Sea, kind of, not exactly, of the fairy court. And there is a bit in one of the novellas that she's written for the series where the Lushak shows up at October Day's bachelorette party, which is basically a giant karaoke night, and does Ursula's song, Poor Unfortunate Souls, from Little Mermaid. And it's priceless.
Souls.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So
nice.
I love that bit.
I just watched the new Little Mermaid live action.
Ooh, yes, I want to see that.
Which was really great. The biggest critique is instead of casting a drag queen for Ursula, they cast Melissa McCarthy, who generally I love, but is not a drag queen.
Yeah, no, that's not.
Yeah, so, yeah. But otherwise, highly recommend it. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in verse 12, we read, "Not that I have already obtained this or have already reached the goal, but I press on to make it my own, because Christ Jesus has made me his own." Okay, if I have one request this week for preachers, it's please do not make me think about diet culture when you talk about faith, because I read this verse and I think to myself, it could go there so easily. If I'm having flashbacks to the terrible Diet magazine articles of the early 2000s, when I hear you talking about Jesus, you are doing it wrong. That is not how this is supposed to work.
I think I totally missed that reference.
Oh, just the pressing on to make your goal.
Oh.
I immediately translated that into goal weight.
Oh.
That's not how Jesus works.
No. Diet culture bad.
Right.
Speaking of, this is probably why I didn't read it that way. In verse 14, we read, I press on towards the goal for the prize of the heavenly call of God in Christ Jesus. And not gonna lie, my immediate reaction was like, okay, but is this prize of the heavenly call of God in Christ Jesus better than a Great British Bake Off cake stand? That's the prize they give to the winners of the Great British Bake Off. So,
and, you know, if they happen to wind up with a bunch of publishing contracts afterwards, that's nice too. But
yeah, but yeah, that's what I thought of. And so like dieting, obviously not even nowhere in my mind.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the best.
That's true.
I'd rather think about Great British Bake Off too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then our gospel reading for this episode is Matthew chapter 21, verses 33 through 46. Jesus foretells his death with a parable and identifies himself as the stone that the builders rejected.
So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think it's really important to point out that in this parable, Jesus doesn't say the reign of heaven is like, or even can be compared to. Jesus just says, listen to another parable, and says the parable. And so Jesus isn't saying this is how God works. And I think a lot of times we're used to like making that what parables are about. And as we know from our episode with AJ, Amy Jill Levine, that's not always helpful or accurate or faithful. And so I was thinking about that and the like trope of self-fulfilling prophecies. And in particular, I think the one that fits so well with this is in Star Wars Revenge of the Sith, which is the third movie in the prequel trilogy, Anakin keeps seeing Padme dying in childbirth and ultimately turns to the dark side to prevent it, and in doing so causes it to happen. And so there's this like the thing that he fears, he lets control him into making it reality instead of just a nebulous fear.
I have to admit, I'm not entirely clear on exactly how that's supposed to work. Like, I think they just said it's the Force that allowed his mood to impact her pregnancy, but...
It's a complicated, like... I mean, I haven't rewatched recently. I will be for our upcoming Horror Nerds at Church season once the strikes are over, but yeah. I do think the Force is involved. Like, there is this connection that they have formed, Padme and Anakin, that does not bode well for Padme.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then as we dive into the verses in verse 33, the landowner, as almost, this is like interesting because it's almost word for word. It feels very connected to the Isaiah reading. And even in like one of the things that I was reading about it, like it is supposed to be a rewrite reference to the Isaiah parable of the vineyard. But there was a landowner who plants a vineyard, puts a fence around it, digs a wine press in it, and builds a watchtower, and then leases it to tenants and goes to another country. And I just have to say, I like this parable I struggle with all the time because I despise absentee landlords and this concept of like sharecropping and as an economic or agricultural system is corrupt, right? Like literally, yeah, the landowner puts in all of this effort and yes, you should be compensated for your work, but literally he's then like leasing it to tenants to do all of the work from there out, and in such a way that instead of everybody has a share necessarily when it's a leasing arrangement, they have to pay whether the crops are good or not.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say he planted a vineyard and gave it 3 years to like start really producing, none of that.
Sure. Also, like, this is weirdly bad theology on Jesus's part. Like, isn't Christianity all about God is not an absentee landlord? Like, God literally came here as Jesus.
Which is why I said what I said in my first comment about the self-fulfilling prophecy. Because Jesus isn't saying this is what God does. He asks the religious leaders And they tell him how they interpret it. And then he's like, and that's how it is. And I wonder if it's, and like, that is how you interpret this parable. And that is how you interpret your faith. And that's not the faith that resonates with Jesus or with, like, I mean, that's not a faith that I am familiar with for any Jewish people that I've ever talked to. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bad theology. Don't just like assume that this parable is
good Jesus theology.
Yeah. And then in verse 35, we read, but the tenants seized his slaves and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. These tenants seem to have a lot of free time and energy. Like, that takes a lot of work. And have they considered using that energy for something else? Like, maybe, you know, I don't know, making more money so that they can pay their landlord more easily. If, you know, if these young tenants just gave up their murderous habits and their expensive avocado toast, they could probably buy their own vineyard. Oh, wait, they're not millennials. And also, that's not how the economy actually works. Never mind.
I was going to say, it's probably they came during the fermentation process. So they've got like a month to just sit around and wait for the fermentation, which is also before they can make any money.
Yeah, which does not, you know, help at all.
Yeah.
And then in verse 38, we read, but when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and get his inheritance. Okay, I really hope this does not come as a surprise to any of our listeners, but this is not how inheritance law works.
What? No way.
Ever. Not even 2,000 years ago in Israel. This actually might be why there is inheritance law and has been for more than 2,000 years, because murder bad. I realize we keep saying that, but there's our reason for it, because murder bad.
It's true.
And now I'm imagining so many of the classic novels of, like, the 1800s from England and Europe and such, where the plot is about the tension of, I have to marry this particular person or else the wrong person is going to inherit our home and legacy. And how different all of those novels would be if the answer was murder instead of arranged marriages. And I have to say, like, I'm against that happening in real life, but fictionally speaking, it could be super interesting.
I mean, yeah. Well, and sometimes this is how inheritance works. If somebody specifically wrote their last will and testament to include, like, who inherits it, and then it's, like in Graceling, King Lech, I mean, like, brainwashed people into, like, thinking he was a good kid, and then giving him...
Brainwashing also bad.
Yeah, brainwashing bad, especially because it led to murder. So then they, like, wrote him in as their heir, and then he, you know, killed them, slash made them kill themselves, or...
Yikes.
Murder bad.
Yeah.
And then in verse 40 we read, now when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? And I just gotta say, like, who's the owner of the vineyard gonna come with? Because if he comes by himself, good luck. But also, like, probably in today's economy, he's gonna decide to cut his losses and abandon the vineyard instead and get a tax write-off. I mean, Tony Stark definitely would have, and I think he did do that with, like, weapons programs and weapons and stuff early on in his, like, career, and his dad, Howard Stark, also, I think, did it. But, like, probably most likely to be a tax write-off these days than any sort of, like, trying to show up and actually, like, fight for a vineyard that you haven't cared about since you created it.
Yeah. Although, I don't think that in ancient Israel you actually could get tax write-offs for that.
I mean, but... details. Also, like, is he going to spend the money to, like, hire an army to go try to seize the property?
That would be a lot, yeah.
Exactly. And now for our most fruitful segment.
Not fruitiest?
I almost did fruitiest. Make a Muppets musical. Okay, who are you casting?
Goodness. Well, So very recently you brought up Bert and Ernie. And as we talk about Paul having his life flipped upside down, I think that Ernie would actually enjoy having his life flipped upside down as long as it was literally speaking, because he would enjoy standing on his head, whether it was for Jesus or just for any other fun reason. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bert would be a little perturbed. And so I was mentally picturing Bert and Ernie standing on their heads during our reading from Philippians. And that was pretty fun.
I love that. I think that's a great one.
How about you?
I actually was thinking about the Isaiah passage, and my immediate thought upon learning about these wild grapes, it was, of course, animal. Like, animal would be such a wonderful wild grape. And then I was thinking about it more, and I was like, oh, maybe the vineyard needs, like, has the vineyard owner tried good compost? Because Oscar probably would be, like, super helpful in that department.
Absolutely. And jumping back to the pop culture segment of our deep dive, I am now imagining Animal helping Lucy stomping the grapes.
Oh my gosh, that would be perfect.
If we're turning things into Muppets, I think that scene could definitely use an extra Muppet.
I think that would be delightful, and I would love Lucille Ball
in any she would have so Muppets much fun.
Musical. Yeah. Oh, that would absolutely be so wonderful. Yeah.
I'm now picturing the whole parable that Jesus tells with Lucy in the background stomping grapes and just sort of livening things up while, you know, the unfortunate murders happen in the foreground.
But you know she would, because she gets that way. Oh, that absolutely. Would be so perfect.
Like, the Muppets are murdering various other Muppets in the foreground and Lucy is in the background stomping grapes. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Thanks for joining us. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, and the Muppets music was by Brenda Boss. Catch us next week when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 20th Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Kay Roloff and Emily Ewing. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and now Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's certainly cheaper than owning a vineyard, but also cheaper than most good bottles of wine.
Sure. Or fighting a murder charge when you kill your landlord's heir.
It's probably cheaper than a minute of any lawyer's time.
Yes, absolutely. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christian said, Pax Vobiscum.